So, you want to know what on earth is happening? Then sit back and listen as this guy next door speaks. And today, I'm going to have a special guest. And this special guest is Tim Kelly, who has his own podcast show called Our Interesting Times. But you know what? Before we get to that, you're listening to Guy Next Door Speaks, and I'm Ivan from Phoenix. And today is Sunday, December 20th, 2015. Now, getting back to our guest. Tim Kelly has been doing this podcast now, I think, what, maybe a year or two. And I've listened to all the episodes, and I've become very fascinated by the guests that he's had on. Very intellectual conversations back and forth, wealth of information. So I recommend people checking out on Podomatic or Google Online, Our Interesting Times, and listen to his shows. So after all this time of listening to Tim and his guests, I decided to throw out an invitation to Tim to have him on and see if he can share with us what he's put together, what he's gathered from all these different guests, information, knowledge, and things that the general public probably has no idea is going on, what they should be talking about. So with that little intro put aside, I'm going to welcome Tim. Tim Kelly, welcome to the Guy Next Door Speaks. Thanks for joining me tonight.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's an honor. I appreciate that very generous introduction.
Oh, okay. Well, that was just off the top of my head real quick. But hey, when you speak truth and honesty, you know, that resonates better than made up, scripted, you know, attempts to sounding smarter than you actually are. So, Tim, yeah. So tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get to where you're at now with all this knowledge and putting this out there on your podcast?
Well, I'm aware that as you learn about these things, the more I learn, I'm humbled by the amount that I don't know. Mm-hmm. So it's a cumulative effect over the years. And if you think you stop learning when you graduate from high school or college, then you're a fool. You never stop learning. In fact, I think it's the beginning of your learning, because you get out of those institutions, those intellectual prisons that the establishment has constructed over the years. Indoctrination centers, yeah. And you learn that's the case too if you learn about the history of the university system or law school or medical schools or, you know, public school, the underground history of of American education, as one book I think is called, why compulsory education was created in this country. And you realize it's all about control, and about particularly mind control. And that, of course, mind control is a term that kind of bothers people because it sounds kind of like science fiction stuff, Hollywood. But really, mind control is a sort of it's a sliding scale, and so it can occur at different levels, but it does begin with our consciousness and what we think is reality and what we think is going on. And we find out what is going on is figuring out what isn't going on, and then you got to start there, and that's what the real debate is. I think it's fairly certain that that the majority of people who imbibe, you know, the mainstream media, entertainment, the mainstream perspective of what's going on, are for the most part clueless. This isn't to show contempt for them. It's just that they simply haven't found the time or the inclination to put in the time that it's required to learn what's going on in the world. I once had someone tell me that I was talking about a few of these things, and they said, "Well, you almost have to obsess on this stuff." And I said, "Well, in a way, you're correct. Yes, you have to obsess on this stuff. You have to, same way a PhD student will obsess on his thesis. You have to obsess on this stuff and put in the time. You cannot rely on academia or the media to boil these things down and put it in a nice little package for us so we have a general understanding of things."
Well, you used the word obsess, but we can simplify it more to the point of caring. What do you actually care about? And we kind of touched on this before we started the podcast with, like, Sundays being a football day, where you got people that actually care so much about football that now it's become a part of their everyday life with this fantasy football stuff. You know, that's what they actually care more to look into than where does their money come from, where what is their government doing, what is happening in the world. So the care, that's another – you can substitute that for obsession, I guess.
Yeah, and into play to take fantasy football seriously or sports in general, you have to fill your brain full of statistics and facts, factoids, and all types of arcane information. And, you know, it's a crowding out effect. There's only so much oxygen in the room. And if you spend your leisure time doing that, you have that much less time to actually know what's going on in the world. People get more passionate about Tom Brady's inflated football than they do about the civil war that was conjured up by the Anglo-American elite in NATO in Syria, which has killed hundreds of thousands of people.
Right.
You know, and it also prevents you from understanding what's going on here as you know, various events occur. You can't compute. You can't analyze these things, understand what's going on until you study history and you realize that this has happened before and there's evidence to support some of the, shall we say, apparently outrageous claims of various conspiracy theorists or conspiracy researchers about certain events.
Well, you know, taking it back to what you were talking about in the beginning about school and education, doesn't that tie into what, around the early 1900s with, was it Rockefeller that he said he wanted a nation of workers and not thinkers?
Yes, competition was a sin. That was competition with him. Hmm. He was an oligarch. He was a monopolistic capitalist, or, he believed that, you know, he and his, that sort of milieu of so-called robber barons or industrialists sought to control things, and they realized if they got started competing with one another and they start to work together, they could dominate the economy, take it over. And one of the steps of doing that was control of education. That was the creation of the General Education Board, I believe, and giving them hundreds, I think it was like $100 million back then, which really jingled in your pocket back then. But they took over education, and they I think compulsory education started like in the middle 19th century up in the New England area, but it spread out from there, and it was done to create a nation of workers, not thinkers. Other steps were taken to monopolize other aspects of the economy and society. I mean, you had, if they couldn't co-op universities, they started their own universities, like the University of Chicago or Vanderbilt University. University of Chicago was the Rockefellers. Amount of University of Chicago developed the discipline of sociology. And sociology is a study of society, which is all geared towards social engineering. That's what it's all about.
Right.
And social engineering is the mass manipulation of people's thoughts and habits and beliefs.
That ties in into telling them what to care and what not to care about also.
Yes, and it gets into entertainment. Entertainment is – I do a lot of interviews with a guy named Jay Dyer, who studies movies, and he gets into Hollywood. And that's one of the things he did, one of his favorite studies, and that's important because it's through the cinema that people are really affected. I mean, not many people read anymore. So right. If you control the cinema, you can really change their, the way they look at the world, or at least what they expect of the world and how people, you're supposed to live. And, if you look at the publishing houses, so Time Life under – the Time Life Empire under Henry Luce, and he was a skull and bonesman, and he went to work for the elite and was rewarded greatly for his efforts. But his Time Life Empire published, I think, Time Magazine, Life Magazine, Fortune, and I think Sports Illustrated. And how all those magazines shape what we expect life to be, the American good life, the American century.
Does that tie into life imitating art and art imitating life?
Yeah, you could say that. That's what the theater does in many respects. Mm-hmm. I mean, people's sexual mores and large. If you look at this, there's almost been a chemical process going on with society. If you look at the past 40, 50 years, the general degradation of society is done through film, literature, publication, academia. There's no real independent actors out there. They're all kind of controlled. Basically, if you're famous, you're of any renown, I think you're one step or another controlled. You're an asset or a puppet.
Yeah.
I think Joe Atwell calls them lifetime actors. That's an interesting term. People like Aldous Huxley, all these characters. Gloria Steinem, CIA, admitted CIA agent now, Ms. Magazine, the third wave feminism. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of the push towards depopulation and birth control, the breakup of the family through feminism did that by encouraging supposed careers among women, although most women don't have careers, they just have two or three jobs to get by.
Right.
You know? And at one time, one a man's paycheck could support a family, a decent middle class lifestyle. That's ending. There's a lot of reason why that's happening. But a lot of it is engineering. You're familiar with Aaron Russo's discussion with Nicholas Rockefeller?
Yes.
And that, yeah. And so you know, it goes back to, you know, what Walter Lippmann and Edward Bernays about creating, you know, manufacturing consent. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, through advertising, consumption, the idea of the good life, you know, the 30-year mortgage, the house in the suburbs. Suburbs were created. They didn't. I think it was Bill Kaufman, the paleoconservative, who wrote in his book, Ain't My America, I think he said something to the effect that the interstate highway system wasn't built by the invisible hand. You know? Huh. It was a military plan. As a, you know, it's a social engineering scheme. So it's one of these things where you start to realize a lot of the stuff that we thought were spontaneous or very stochastic events that, you know, kind of just occur, just a marketplace. It isn't. It's we're being manipulated. And I could give you a bunch of specifics in that regard if you wanted to know. But
well, I'm thinking of one example, like when women started smoking. That was like a propaganda thing by Bernays to have those, were they liberty sticks or something, having women
liberty torches, yeah,
liberty torches, right, through Times Square or something, doing some parade or something that they were seen with this, and it just caught on, and next thing you know, now women are smoking everywhere.
And it was a manufactured news story.
Hmm.
That's another interesting thing. It was a news story that was solely manufactured. It was a public relations stunt, because he was the father of public relations, you know. But it was, you know, the Rockefellers, they hired Ivy Lee. He's a PR guy. And that's why they started, you know, donating money to charity, supposedly. It was a PR stunt. But it also was a move to take over things, because through philanthropy, you could take over the arts, take over the universities, take over the medical schools and impose your vision on the world. And that's what they did, you know. And it's sort of a full spectrum dominance approach to these things. And
it hasn't stopped. It hasn't stopped, because this thing within the last 10, 15 years, this apparently sudden boom in openness of homosexuality and everything, they don't touch on the chemical effect and, you know, the food and the water and the medications and all these studies that show, like frogs or tadpoles, that their sexes have been changing just based on the water from, like, women's birth control and things that's in their urine, that it goes into the water. And yet this water gets filtered and we're drinking that water and we see this increase in homosexuality. But yet we have the LGBT movement and everything. Oh, that's natural. Love us for how we are. But never realizing, wait, why is there such an increase? Why are we this way? What's going on? Is there another reason? And no one wants to look at there.
Well, yeah, these endocrine disruptors, and people don't really say, "Oh, you're making gay people," and they kind of make fun of that point or that viewpoint. But no, it's obviously the male. If you know anything about embryology, you know, is everything starts out as a female. Every fetus is a female at one point. Hormones rush in, and the male is created. And if you disrupt that with endocrine disruptors or estrogen mimicking chemicals, which is admittedly these the food has it, the things that hold the food have it, they don't need to be used.
The plastics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the plastics and all that. The imposition of plastics was a conspiracy, when they marginalized hemp. But if you disrupt that process, you can create if you're not homosexuals, sexual ambiguity. And that's what happens, apparently. And so, yeah, it's you don't get the rush of hormones to fully form in the male. That can be in the brain. The male brains and female brains are different. I don't want to shock anybody, but that's just the fact, mm-hmm. You know. And men and women do think differently. That's just the way it is. And that used to be. Now, what happens is a lot of the, I guess you could say, the sexual revolutionaries who were agents of these people, of the Rockefellers and other interested parties, used to be the nurture nature argument. You know, particularly homosexuality. Well, now, you know, what they're trying to do is change the nature, and that's with these chemicals. You know, it's hard. I don't know another explanation, because they BPA, bisphenol A, was a known hormonal treatment in the 30s, so they knew it would do this. Yet they put this product on in the plastics and the products that people consume. You know, so used to consume. So it's hard to come up with any other explanation why they would do that. Again, you know,
that's just another chapter in that, you know, changing reality, changing, destroying the family, like you said. Now, if, you know, hey, okay, they can love each other, but if it's two guys or two girls, there goes the reproduction is pretty much out the window. So there's more of a, did this fall under that slow kill that you mentioned before? One of the things is something about, that's like another way of slow killing, right? It's like a slow genocide where we're not doing anything, but yet, through the chemicals that are out there, the public thinks, oh, this is normal, you know, gay pride and all this stuff. But wait, no, this is slowly but surely destroying your lineage. You don't get to reproduce. There's an intention here that you're not aware of.
Well, one thing, there's the assault, you could say the biochemical assault with the endocrine disruptors and the food and the clothing and the packaging and all that. Then there's also the cultural assault, the cultural Marxism in the schools, and the promotion of homosexuality, or just confusion, sexual moral confusion. Mm-hmm. And we've come to a point where to question the morality of homosexuality is to be considered a bigot. All you're doing is drawing criticism of someone's supposedly chosen behavior.
Homophobic or something.
Even people today, that's that Seinfeld joke. Not that there's anything wrong with it. Everyone feels compelled to say that, but there's obviously something wrong with it, because it makes no sense from a biological standpoint. Sex. I'm going to shock everybody. But sex is for procreation. Mm-hmm. The reason why sex is pleasurable is because the creator, nature, whoever did it, knew that if you make it pleasurable, you get procreation. It's a healthy thing to procreate. Any species wants to procreate. So, you know, and God in his infinite wisdom created females in a certain form, and male in a certain form. And I think the fact that the females exist in the shapes and the ways they do, and men exist in the shapes and the ways they do, proves that God is not only, God is not only all-knowing, he also has an incredible sense of humor.
That also leads to a form of cognitive dissonance in society, doesn't it? Because if a man looks at a woman his natural way, like, oh, they look at him like some kind of sexual deviant or stalker, and if a woman looks at a man with that same way, she's a whore or a slut. So it's a mind game, saying, wait a minute, this is the natural way it should go, but when we act on it, no. Don't do that. There has to be a proper protocol, you know, date, get married, then you do it. It's like, wait a minute.
Well, because there was a time when people associated sex with babies, mm-hmm. particularly girls, because girls would be carrying the child. So they need someone reliable to take care of them when they're pregnant. So, you know, the way it worked, traditionally speaking, was that girls knew how to behave. Girls more or less shaped the behavior of the male. The males knew that, you know, in order to get the girl, he had to prove himself in many ways, in different ways, whether earning capability or just responsibility or respect. And it wasn't perfect. Obviously, it wasn't perfect. Nothing's perfect this side of paradise. But the bottom line, I guarantee that most kids were nurtured with the benefit of a two-parent household,
right,
and everything that comes from that. And the bottom line is, although it's not perfect, there are a lot less social pathologies involved in a healthy two-parent household than there are with a single-parent household. If you have more single-parent households, majority of whom, 90% of whom, are run by women, you're going to have a lot more social pathology. And those women those families are going to be much more dependent on government and care, and they're going to behave a certain ways.
Which is another chapter of the intention, dependency on the government.
And that was the intention. It wasn't to help anybody. It was to get them dependent. That was the – I mean, are you familiar with Daryl Hamamoto?
Yes.
You wrote the book Servitors of Empire?
Well, I haven't read his books, but I've heard several of his podcasts him interviewed on several podcasts.
How those sociologists studied the effect of the Japanese families when they were interred.
Right.
And this became a – this factored into the creation of the Great Society programs in the 60s, which finished off the black family. I mean, because if you go into the 50s and 60s, all the indices for black Americans were improving. Mm-hmm. Poverty rate was dropping 1% a year between 1946 and 1964 in the post-war boom. I think illegitimacy rates were kind of high, but they were 13%, and the norm was a family. 25 years later, it was the exact opposite. And now we have illegitimacy rates that are close to 80%, 100% in some of the neighborhoods, some of the ghettos. And so you have complete societal breakdown.
Let's touch on that, if you don't mind, real quickly. That's some of your most recent interviews. I don't know the gentleman's name. Is that Dr. Michael something?
Michael Jones.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was very, very fascinating because I wasn't aware of that, how in a roundabout way they took blacks from the South once they, quote unquote, were free, or, you know, hey, now no more segregation, whatever. You're free to go wherever you want. But they didn't really want to go anywhere, but they were kind of forced up to the northern states or northern cities to disrupt certain communities. Can you break that down a little bit here real quick?
Yeah, that's in his book, Slaughter of Cities. E. Michael Jones is a traditional Catholic scholar, historian, prolific writer, and he's written a number of very detailed, wonderfully written, long books about these things. He analyzes these things in a way that no one really does, and his perspective is very important on these. He helps you understand.
It does connect quite a few dots.
Yes. And one thing that's interesting is his research is consistent with others like Jan Ervin and Dave McGowan and these who aren't really considered religious. But when you run into people coming from different viewpoints, coming up with the same conclusion, very similar research, you realize you're onto something. I'm Catholic, so a lot of what Dr. Jones writes speaks to me in a way, because I understand these things. The Slaughter of Cities was about the destruction of the urban neighborhoods in the middle of the 20th century. And this, again, it wasn't a market process. It wasn't a voluntary process or an organic process. It was all part of social engineering. And there are a lot of facets to it, a lot of interest behind doing it. One was the WASP elite looked very suspiciously at the growing Catholic political power in the country. Mm-hmm. And by the middle of the 20th century, the Catholics in America were politically ascendant. I mean, in 1960, they elected John F. Kennedy. Mm-hmm. And his Catholicism probably factored into his assassination. There were other factors, but his Catholicism and the fact that the Kennedy family were never really in part of the WASP elite factored into why he and his brother were murdered. What happened was they looked at these Catholic neighborhoods, and various sociologists had tried to try to get into some of these Polish Catholic neighborhoods, Ukrainian, Lithuanians, and all that, and they found them to be impenetrable. From that standpoint, they spoke their language, their own little tongue, and also they were devoted to their parish. And so, remember, this is during World War II, mm-hmm. and you also had a book called Catholic Power and American Freedom. That was written that the premise said that Catholics were by their nature fascistic and they had needed to be assimilated and changed. And so the neighbors needed to be broken up. And one of the processes of breaking them up was using integration. And this also came along during the war when there was a shortage of labor, and they shipped up a bunch of former sharecroppers from the South and put them into these urban neighborhoods in the North, and didn't really provide them any housing accommodation. And they intentionally put in these neighborhoods to create racial strife. Mm. And it wasn't intended to integrate and create racial harmony. It was to create actually discord and violence.
Although that was part of the excuse, right? We want to integrate and, you know, harmony, and, you know, we don't want any discrimination or racism here, so we can put them together. But again, that was...
And this guy named Louis Wirth, who I think... was a sociologist at the University of Chicago. I might have that wrong in that detail. But he studied this stuff. And I think in a speech in the 40s, he said that the Americans can no longer be allowed to decide where they want to live.
Mm.
Okay? And so what happened was you get the blacks in sharecropping southern blacks into the city. They're from the South, and they're all of a sudden they're free in the big cities, and they're going to respond in a certain way. And they did. You get uprooted people, a lot of young men, you're going to get crime. And that was expected. And that's what happened. And all of a sudden you have these race riots. And, you know, the media reported it as there was a bunch of white racists attacking black people. When really, you know, there was no white people. There was, you know, there were Lithuanians, there were Poles, there were Irish, there were Italian. You know, it wasn't a black-white thing. But the intention was to create white flight. And so the carrot...
The blacks were pretty much just thrown into the fray and left to fend for themselves.
Yeah, and then, you know, and so the stick, you could say, was the moving of you know, former black sharecroppers into the cities. The carrot was FHA and the 30-year mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
And this also coincides with the construction of the interstate highway system, which was part of a kind of a military planning contingency. Eisenhower had been impressed with the highways in Germany, the Autobahn. But it was all part of dispersing the country. You know, they thought maybe people were too concentrated in the cities. But the idea was to create suburbia. And this is where the Ford Foundation, the Quakers, and got interested in trying to break up these ethnic Catholic neighborhoods. Because with these ethnic Catholic neighborhoods, these people were just weren't homogenized enough from the standpoint of these think tanks and foundations, who were controlled by Rockefellers, you know, the WASP elite. And so the figure is the one way you break up these ethnic neighbors and change their living habits, change their birth rates, was to disperse them in the suburbia. And once they're dispersed in the suburbia, they become deracinated, they lose their Catholic identity, and they're no longer Irish Catholic Americans or Italian Catholic Americans or Lithuanian Americans or Polish Americans. They become the white middle class.
Hmm.
And once they're the white middle class, they can be convinced to engage in consumption, middle class lifestyle, these things. And once they lose their ethnic identity, and they're particularly their Catholic identity, they become the, sort of this bland, deracinated American middle class that can then be subjected to the psychological warfare of, you know, music and consumption and TV and these things. So
that's interesting. You said losing their culture, their personality, or their identity, because people tend to think that that's just happened to the black
people. Yeah, and most importantly, their birth rates are curbed, which is a big concern for the Rockefellers. They were behind the birth control pill. They were behind feminism, and they're behind promotion of homosexuality. The Ford Foundation, was a big funder of the Kinsey research.
Right.
And a lot of this involves intelligent agencies. If you talk about intelligent agencies, it's kind of a semantic argument. Whether it's the foundations or the intelligent agencies, they're all interrelated. They all come from, they all, you know, are supported by the same establishment, the corporate interest of Standard Oil, or, you know, corporate America, United Fruit, Wall Street, the banks, you know. So
it's an octopus with a whole bunch of tentacles.
Yeah,
it's all over the place.
Yeah, and so that's what happened, you know, in much of the integration of the 60s. I mean, we tend to think of it as sort of this progressive thing, and to criticize it is to be a racist. But the bottom line is, these people, these groups, the elite were exploiting real fissures, real problems. It isn't to say that groups didn't have real problems, nor say the problems should be redressed, but Their objective wasn't to solve the problems, it was to exasperate them and achieve some other ulterior end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't talk about the fact that the entire country was being subjected to a social experiment, you know.
Right.
And telling people where to live, you know. And now it's moved up to the point where now the, you know, HUD right now is targeting neighborhoods that they consider too white.
Huh.
You see. And, you know, who do these people think they are? They can do that, you know, but that's how they think, you know. They can play with people's lives that way, you know.
And would you say today it's no longer or not as much on the race or religion? Now it's on the monetary, put all the rich over here and let all the poor somewhere else. And if you want to destroy this rich area, that's when you start offering, you know, programs or stuff where middle class or lower income family could get in there. So that now the money, the income level, that's become another tool that's being used against the people?
Well, I think for the most part, honestly speaking, I think race relations on an individual level are probably better than ever in this country. I think most Americans don't walk around when they go out to work thinking, but, you know, I'm gonna go attack someone of a different race.
You know what? That's funny, because I did come across something similar to that, addressing that a week or so ago, that for all the stuff we see on the news about white cops, black victims, or, you know, anti-Muslim this and all that, that the U.S. really globally is the most tolerant of all different races and cultures in the planet. But yet, again, there's that cognitive dissonance or obfuscation of taking reality and flipping it and making everybody think, oh my God, it's so much racism, discrimination, and America's so terrible. It's like, wait, it's the opposite.
Well, that's why you had that ludicrous protest in Missouri a couple months ago.
Black Lives Matter and all that?
Yeah, yeah. And then, I mean, there's like I said,
it's not to say that it doesn't exist.
Yeah,
it's just being blown way out of proportion.
Yeah. Well, the militarization of the police mm-hmm. brutality, these things are a reality. There are specific programs that have, whether it's the drug war, the 1033 program, where military equipment is given to police departments, DHS, and there's all types of grants and financial incentive for these police forces to become militarized and become brutal in many respects, particularly the drug war. Mm-hmm. It pays to have drug raids for these, so they're going to have more drug raids. They can have more SWAT raids, and more people will be brutalized. There's been a qualitative change in the training and equipping of police. That's going to have an effect. At the same token, there is also the problem of crime among young black youths, particularly males. We cannot deny that. That they look at the statistics. They're off the charts for young black men. That's just a reality. It doesn't say that all black men are given to crime. It's just that they do have a problem in that community. And the reason why that is for the reasons that I stated earlier in the interview. That you had the breakdown of the family and all the pathologies that come from that in the black community. Mm-hmm. So if you have 80% illegitimacy in one community, one group, you're going to have much more problems in that group. They can be much more vulnerable.
Right,
but also they can be excited easier too. They can be instigated in the causing these problems. This is probably why you have some sort of COINTELPRO operation occurring in many of these cases. I mean, George Soros was caught spending $30 million down in Ferguson, at the Soros Foundation, sending in people to protest to make the situation worse.
And there were some people that caught on to that, right? That they noticed, you know what? A lot of these riots and looting is happening by people coming in from outside. It's not our own people doing this. But yet, the media covered it as, in general, there's looting going on down there. There's mass hysteria. And you would think, oh, it's the people down there. They don't know how to behave. But no, it's not them. It's being staged.
Well, Soros' Open Foundation, USAID, and these other NGOs are pulling these things off in the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
They're sending in proxy. What do you think ISIS is? It's a proxy force for NATO, an Anglo-American power structure. You know, if you look at ISIS, it operates out of Turkey, which is a NATO country. It's funded by the Gulf states, which are U.S. puppets, and it's not attacking Israel, is it? It's supposedly pulling off terrorist attacks in Paris, and now we have ISIS-inspired events here in this country.
Right.
I suspect those are just. Again, or some sort of false flag or drills gone live again, just to, a part of a sort of a Gladio operation occurring in this country. And if you don't know what Gladio is, which many people still don't know, Gladio was a series of false flag attacks carried off in the 60s through the 80s, now by Western intelligence agencies, NATO, and various, Masonic, the P2 Lodge, and criminal elements, pinned on like Red Guard brigade, Red Brigades, and communists, but really, it was the Western intelligence agencies' strategy of tension to change the politics in the target countries, and that was discovered both by an Italian parliamentary investigation and a judicial investigation. Several books have been written on that, and now it's just a part of history. We admit it. So to suggest that something similar isn't going on in this country. To suggest that something like that might be going on in this country to change the politics is not out of left field. I think it's a valid suspicion.
And this ties into what we were talking about at the beginning as far as education, because if you have an uneducated or not properly educated or a public that doesn't know how to think, they've been taught what to think, you can keep playing the same old scam every generation, and they're not the wiser to pick up because they don't know how to think. They can't recognize these patterns, or they can't even look at history. They won't even know.
I mean, if you look at I've often cited, but I think it's important. It's the Operation Northwoods.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1962 when the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, General Lyman Lemonser, submitted a plan to President Kennedy to carry out false flag attacks in southern Florida and other areas in the United States, and blame it on Cuba to justify an invasion of the island nation. Part of that plan was what? Real and fake casualties in the United States. Real casualties. Fake casualties, would have required what might we now call crisis actors. Mm-hmm. There was a plan to blow up a drone plane, and claim that there are college students aboard. Presumably, there would have been people playing the role of grieving loved ones, crisis actors.
Mm-hmm.
You have fake news stories about attacks. That in its own way is creating false witnesses, because there'd be false reports to do all these things to justify, you know, the invasion of the island. So there is on a record members, you know, plans created in the upper echelons of the national security state, proposing that very thing. Now, Kennedy fired Lyman Lemonser and sent him out to NATO. And coincidentally, that's when Gladio started in Europe. You know, whatever inference you want to get from that, fine.
I'm thinking, if it doesn't work here, Dan, this is such a good idea. We can't put it to waste. Where is it going to work? Over there? Good. There we go. Send it over there.
Yeah. And just recently I've read that apparently Professor Trace, James Tracy,
mm-hmm.
might be losing his job at Florida State University for his views regarding Sandy Hook and perhaps some other events. And his theory is that no one died there. It was some sort of drill or phony event. Now, that sounds crazy to a lot of people, but a lot of people simply take as gospel what they watch on the news.
Right.
And Tracy and other people have researched that event and found a whole lot of inconsistencies and anomalies that cannot be reconciled with how the event was reported to us. But it gets back to education. Now, that's his view of things, and if you're familiar with his work, he's a very sane person, very balanced and fair, and scholarly person. He just has an opinion about a certain event that doesn't jibe with the official story, and for that he might be losing his job at his university, despite the fact of having tenure. You got to control education. You can't have a loose cannon like that.
Right, and that. That goes along the lines of something Crystal Clark said, accusing faces, right? There's somebody who's not going to toe the line, who applies critical analysis, critical thinking, and says, wait a minute, this, you know, 1 + 1 = 2 and 2 + 2 = 4. Mm-hmm. I cannot lie. This is the facts right here. And yeah, wow.
And
so
this
is something coming up again, right? Because I know initially, one or two years ago when it happened, a few months afterwards, he was talking about this and they threatened him with this. But now over the last year and a half, he's had a podcast show, a website, and he's become more, animate or more vocal about this. So I guess now stepping on the toes again, and now they're trying to come after him again.
Well, I know Anderson Cooper went after him. And my point is, why would, Florida State University, I'm sure, is a fine institution, but it's not Yale. Right. So why are they focusing so much attention on this one professor, instead of maybe even investigating the accusations, what evidence is there? I mean,
they're committing that logical fallacy. They're attacking the messenger instead of the actual message. Yeah.
And the fact that the media just because the media reported the event as a massacre is no reason to believe that it was indeed a real massacre. Again, that sounds crazy. A lot of people, they think what they watch on the TV is true, but what you're watching on television is just a show. It's presented to us. Patrick Henningsen at 21st Century Wire made this point late last summer when they had that shooting event here in Virginia. And supposedly that reporter and the cameraman were shot dead by that guy. He made the point that people in the news are like actors. They even use fake names in many cases.
Hmm.
You know, so, and there's no responsibility, no legal responsibility for these news outlets, the media, to tell you the truth. In fact, they have a fiduciary responsibility to their stockholders, and the stockholders often rely on them telling untruths. to sell their products, to boost ratings. So if anything, they have more of a legal obligation to mislead and manipulate the public than to inform the public. And that's not – I don't think I'm being conspiratorial. I think that may be happening when you consider that the media in this country, the 90% of the media is controlled by a dozen corporations.
Right. You know what's one thing that ties perfectly into this that maybe 2-3 weeks ago I came across and I had no idea about this? There was a YouTube video that I saw that it was recorded back in 2013, and it was this lady breaking down something. I'm not sure if it was in the NDAA or something, but she broke down an amendment that was done in 2012, in I think May of 2012, that there was a law that prohibited the government from using propaganda on its people. But there was an amendment that went through in May of 2012 saying that the government now can use propaganda in media, newspaper, television, internet, all different forms of communications on its public. So they amended that. And then that same year in December came Sandy Hook. And that's when we started to see a real increase on, again, what Crystal Clark calls reality revisionism, where we see stuff happening live or first people on the scene saying one thing, and then gradually a time goes by, the original reports are put aside and a new story is put out to the public.
Yeah, that was the there was a specific law that banned that, but that I'm not naive. I think the government been ignoring that law for better part of a century.
Yeah, they just made it legit. Yeah,
yeah, made it legal. There was also back in the early 2000s a plan by the Pentagon that was leaked that they would actually plant false terror. The Pentagon would create false terrorist organizations supposedly to confuse the evildoers. But again, that's one of these things where even if the program were created for that intention, one could very easily see how it would be abused. You create false terrorist organizations or groupings, or maybe plant stories in the media, things like this. So you can do a lot of things. Just by simple planting stories in the media, you can short markets, right? You could, if you were to report something bad happening somewhere in the world, and you had advanced knowledge of that story coming out, you could short bonds or stocks in that given, in that country and make a lot of money. And I'm not, that's, what happened with 9/11. That's interesting. So that's what's going on too. There are certain parties going to have foreknowledge of these events and they're going to capitalize on it. Mm-hmm. I believe it was Catherine Austin Fitz tells a story that just prior to the tsunami, there was a huge shorting of Indonesian stock.
Wow.
And she didn't understand why this was happening, and all of a sudden the tsunami hit. And she said this in several interviews, but she's told people that I don't know if I can be a financial planner. if somewhere out there someone has the ability to predict these things or create these things. But yet again, such an anomaly is usually treated in investigative circles as foreknowledge of an event. And of course, we had that with 9/11 too, with airlines, the affected airlines, and the securities firms that were targeted at the towers, Cantor Fitzgerald, and the Marsh McLennan, these outfits.
And those are some of the offices that were on the floors that got pretty much directly hit by the plane.
Directly hit, yeah.
Right.
Okay.
What are the odds?
What are the odds of that? Fine. But Cantor Fitzgerald, of course, I think was also involved in the clearing of the $240 billion in Brady bonds, which some researchers have linked to what they call Project Hammer. There are $240 billion in fraudulent bonds. There was part and parcel of the looting of the former Soviet Union in the 90s. Hmm. And they were due to, come due on September 12, 2001. And what happened was the devastation on Wall Street that day, or on Manhattan that day, justified the lifting of certain regulations and certification processes of the bonds. And also there was the creation of hundreds of billions of dollars to goose the market. And some people think was used to pay off the bonds.
Wow.
So someone made out like a bandit. literally. So that's part of one of the dimensions to the events of 9/11.
And not to mention the Pentagon also, where on the 10th you have Rumsfeld talking about what trillions that were missing, and then the next day the department that was probably going to investigate that, or where the records were kept or something, that's decided to get hit supposedly by the plane.
Yeah, the accountants, the naval office that was investigating these things was directly hit.
Again, just a coincidence.
Supposedly by a plane.
Supposedly, right.
You know, like I said, I'm often told not to think otherwise. I'm being a nut, but I just don't see anything there to indicate that necessarily that a plane hit there. I've been told a plane hit there, but there's a lot of problems with that, with aeronautics and, you know.
Uh-huh. And then we have Building 7 where, you know, a lot of the, you know, the mayor's office and security and all this kind of high-tech offices were in that building, and yet that building collapses, and that's where a lot of the records are of, you know, that what was there. There was like a lot of things in that Building 7 for it to come down just based on office fires.
Yeah, a lot of investigations, as he sees there, documents were stored there. Similar thing occurred at the Oklahoma City, the FRP Murrah building. The documents were stored there. They were taken there from Arkansas to Oklahoma City during that investigation of, you know, the Clinton scandals, the Whitewater. Of course, that wasn't just the Clintons, because if you investigate the Clintons and Whitewater and Arkansas Development Corporation, you open up a can of worms of MENA, cocaine, CIA, George Bush. They start to unpeel that onion, and you see why perhaps at least one of the justifications for pulling off that attack. And that's another thing where if you dig into it, that the official account just is absurd.
Right, right. That's another great episode you did with the filmmakers of that film. Like, if I remember correctly, you had them on there, right? That was early on your show?
Yeah, I had a couple. There was
Perloff or something.
Perloff Hanley talked about it, and also not James Lane. What's his name? Sorry. He's the producer. He's the one of he's the head of Freemind Films.
Right.
And his name fails me right now. I'm sorry.
Right. That was Oklahoma. What was the name of that documentary? A Noble Lie.
A Noble Lie, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's a must-see for anyone who – that's probably the documentary on that particular event.
Right, right. Yeah. Okay. And so from here, where do we go from here? What else can we tie in from your vast group of guests? What's an area that you're like, this ties in perfectly with this?
Well, my first guest from my inaugural show was the late Dave McGowan.
Oh, yeah.
And he was very gracious to come on my show and spend a lot of time with me for that interview. And I had read his books and really listened to so many of his interviews that it went really well, because I was really familiar with his work. But that's a story, that some of his research, because that's – talk about going on a rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. He wrote – he had an approach to these things. He sort of had kind of like a Farmer Brown logic to these things. And he had a way of writing, which was real, I mean, just kind of like real approachable and real pleasant. Yeah. And so the way he would take on a topic, and it would just sound crazy. By the end of it, you're thinking, you know, it's obvious, you know, whether it's the moon landing or, you know, the Laurel Canyon scene or the Columbine massacre. And, you know, or even he's even taken on the Lincoln assassination
at the end there. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and so his death was a real loss, but yeah, his work and so when I interviewed him, we primarily talked about the Laurel Canyon scene, how sort of the rock music scene was in Laurel Canyon, the folk rock scene, and some of these bands like the Grateful Dead, the Byrds, Crosby, Stills and Nash and Young, and even smaller groups, you know, like Captain Beefheart and the Monkees. These were all like, of course, everyone knows the Monkees were prefab, but some of these other bands were prefab as well. And not only didn't they play their instruments, they were much of the sound we heard were like produced by what were called the Wrecking Crew, which was these session musicians, people like Glenn Campbell, Leon Russell, Hal Blaine, but these bands were formed not just to produce music and sell records, but to change the culture. Again, it's all part of a weaponized anthropology. And it was there to promote drug use, to alienate the anti-war movement in the eyes of the of, you know, the silent majority of middle-class Americans, promote a certain hippie image. Prior to that, the anti-war movement was kind of academic and intellectual and respectable, and it became long hairs, hippies, and drugs. You know, this coincided with the COINTELPRO, which, you know, created groups like the Weathermen, which came out of SDS, but some of the most violent elements of these groups were assets, controlled assets of the intelligence agencies, to create a strategy of tension to shift the politics of the country. Interesting enough, Weathermen, none of them ever went to jail for their crimes. So he wrote about that. And then also the more disturbing aspects we wrote was the phenomenon of the serial killer.
Right.
And the evidence that he dug up and others have dug up have created a pretty strong reason to suspect that the serial killer in the United States wasn't some organic, you know, phenomena developing out of post-war America. It was a creation of the intelligence agencies and something sort of like a domestic application of the Phoenix Project. And I also interviewed Doug Valentine on the Phoenix Project. He wrote a book about the Phoenix Project. He also wrote a couple books about the drug war, Strength of the Wolf and Strength of the Pack, which are must reads if you want to know about the politics of the drug war in this country.
Wow.
The idea was if you know anything about, you know, are you familiar with Phoenix in Vietnam?
Yes. Yeah.
It was, you know, it was basically ostensibly it was a counterinsurgency program, but you know how those things go. And basically in Vietnam, we special forces intelligence assets would go in, kidnap people, torture them, go after supposed Viet Cong or enemies. But in a civil war, you don't know, right? You're getting mm-hmm. you're sweeping a lot of people up, and there's a lot of also local vendettas that are being satisfied in the process. But part of that also was going into the countryside and terrorizing the Vietnamese peasants, and idea, and they'd go in and they'd go into a village and slaughter it in grisly ways, and the people and the men would come back to the village and find their families slaughtered. This was part of a psychological warfare program mm-hmm. in Vietnam. Dave McGowan's theory was that a lot of these more than a few of these serial killers were attached to military intelligence. Some claim to be CIA agents, like Henry Lucas, who was one of America's most prolific serial killers, who claimed he was an assassin for the for the U.S. government. Interesting.
Well, I got about three films bouncing around in my head that I think deal with this. In the first Lethal Weapon, they mentioned the Phoenix Project, mm-hmm. that they were mercenaries out there, but funded by the CIA, and it was part of the drugs. And then you have Jacob's Ladder, where Tim Robbins' character, he was doing, you know, just came back all messed up in the head based on what happened in Vietnam. And then I'm also thinking about even the Van Damme, Dolph Lundgren movie, Universal Soldier, where you have these guys. It's almost like an MK Ultra thing, just super soldiers, guys that are just programmed to go out there and just kill and whatever. And the Dolph Lundgren one fits what you were talking about, destroy a village and very brutal and grotesque. And he even had like people's ears around his necks and everything. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wait a minute, what the hell's going on here? And then you get these people coming back here, and they're going to work at a bank or anything? No, you got to put them to do that same kind of craziness over here. And then mm-hmm. there you have your serial killers.
And it was, I think most recently we've had American Ultra.
Yes.
You know, which I just saw, just rented it. And I was just, you know, you,
isn't it amazing that even the name, it took me a while to get the name. I was like, duh, right there, they're telling you, America's version of MK Ultra, American Ultra, right there.
You know, one case, I think, was Arthur Shawcross, who was a serial killer, who I think he was quoted as saying he joined the U.S. military so he could murder legally. Mm. You know, but they're all part of this Phoenix operation. If you look at people like Jeffrey Dahmer, he was part of the U.S. military. Of course, you had the DC shooters. Remember that a few years ago?
Yes. Was that the black dude that was in the trunk and sniping at people or something?
John Allen Muhammad.
Yep.
That's, you know, he also wrote about that. The weird connections with John Allen Muhammad. He had, you know, again, unaccounted financial support. He's unemployed, but he was traveling to the Caribbean. He sent his kids to private school, and all types of weird, you know, to suggest he had support, or he had some sort of form of financial support.
They always say follow the money.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of these operations that you could create all type of mayhem, and interspersed in that mayhem, or you know, kill a bunch of people, and in between 10 people, there's one target. You know.
Yes.
You know, there's an the recent movie, the show called The Blacklist.
Right, I'm familiar with that. I don't watch that one. That's yeah. James Spader.
It's James Spader, and there's an episode where there's a hired assassin, a hitman, who's I guess you could say his MO is creating train wrecks, plane crashes, and within those plane crashes you have, you know, 60, 70, 80 victims, and there's one person that wanted to be, you know, that was the target. Mm-hmm. You obscure it with a bunch of bodies, and that's said in the movie, and there's a line in the movie where he literally goes, he is probably one of the most prolific killers out there, if we discount governments and other terrorist organizations.
Jeez. Yeah.
But so that was part of the thesis in the serial killer, because the serial killer served many functions. One, his Dave McGowan's idea was that one thing was that it was like sort of a form of murder, modern form of murder incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one way you get rid of people. Another thing was, as part of a strategy of tension, is you create the fear of the serial killer that further, I guess you could say, further advances the objective of the police state. It changes the politics, and it creates fear. He talked about how it atomized society, how there wasn't a time when kids would go out and play and they'd be on their own out and exploring, climbing, you know, getting the woods, climbing trees, getting mm-hmm. cuts and bruises and sometimes getting hurt. But this is what children did. Now, if you look at it, kids now just, you know, they're sealed in their SUVs and these baby seats that they have to sit until they're 15 or something. Yeah. No one walks home from school anymore. When I was a kid, I walked home from school, you know, by myself many right. times. You know, just didn't think, you know, I knew to look both ways. I knew not to talk to strangers, all these things. But, you know, I was pretty much in the summertime or around school. I would go off and play with my brothers and without any adult supervision. Now, when a kid does that, he's called a free-range kid and he's taken to custody by police, and the parents mm-hmm. are questioned.
Right.
And that's all part of the social engineering agenda there. So that was his theory on that. And again, he, you know, all these kids, the circuit, whether it's John Wayne Gacy, who despite being a convicted sex offender, was able to have dinner with then First Lady Rosalynn Carter.
Hmm.
His case, when the police went into his house, and although he was already suspected as being involved in maybe the missing and some of these boys that were missing and where he was, and the police went into his house, and although they found objects belonging to one of the missing kids, and they said they smelled an odd odor, they did not arrest him. You know, and the same thing happened with Jeffrey Dahmer, if you recall.
Uh-huh.
The police were giving him a pass. You know, and he talked about Jeffrey Dahmer when he was in high school in D.C. in the late 70s. He was able to call up and get a personal tour of the vice president's office.
He's got it like that.
So I don't know what, I mean, because
what the hell,
you know, so there's some sort of connection there. And the idea is these people are groomed or they're identified in some way and they, you know, and they're sent out to, you know.
That literally breaks it down to the us and them, because there's the laws that apply to us and the laws that yeah. don't apply to them. And you can tell who's in those circles, because when you got people even on the farther, as you know, how do I put it, the far edges of the circle, they're still kind of protected.
Yeah.
That falls into like maybe what, until their deathbed, like the Jimmy Savills or people like that. Yeah. While they're alive, they can do all the craziness, but they won't get touched. But then once they're dead, what's it matter? Then everything else comes out.
Well, that was it with in Program to Kill, which is the book I'm talking about. The first 30-40% is about organized pedophilia, child, you know, human trafficking.
Right,
because it fits into this. And one case he talks about is the Marc Dutroux affair in Belgium, and he was this unemployed electrician who apparently owned half a dozen homes with dungeons in them.
Wow!
And no one explains how he got the funds for those things. He was also a convicted rapist who got out like after 3 years, got out early, And he also had a virtually unlimited prescription from the Belgian government for Rohypnol, which I think is Rupee, which is the rape drug. Mm-hmm. I think. And so the idea, the evidence there suggests that he was a procurer for the elite. And that, of course, there are rumors regarding human trafficking in NATO and some of the elite members of parliament there. Same thing goes with Jimmy Savile in England, the members of parliament and various high-level officials. You know, in this country, we've had the Franklin scandal,
right.
The Presidio scandal, which also links into Satanism and central intelligence agencies Colonel Michael Aquino,
right,
who I think is the head of the Temple of Set, who also happened to write the manual for chaplains for the Pentagon. So you have a Satanist writing the manual for the chaplains at the Pentagon. He also was over there at NSA, but he was apparently involved. He was identified by a couple of the witnesses in regards to the Franken scandal and also the Presidio, where one of the children gave a detailed explanation of his quarters. So when they served
Courtney Love one of those children or something?
That John Potash in his book, Courtney Love apparently was a child at the Presidio. Mm-hmm. And it gets into what's going on here is the child trafficking and Satanism. These are all sort of tools that are used to either to keep it at an arm's length or to facilitate whether it's drugs or human trafficking. The Satanist angle might be designed there to throw people off, I think. I think it factors into it, but I think ultimately I think that makes people think it's some Hollywood thing. And but if you look at the role of the occult and in intelligence and the history of that Aleister Crowley was a British intelligence agent, and he was also a Satanist. So there's some sort of attachment with the occult, which is basically just secreted knowledge. Necessarily mean you're, but it factors into that with intelligence and the formation and how these intelligence agencies operate, at least how one level of them operate. They're not monolithic, obviously.
You want to know what's kind of funny? Synchronistically, we're talking Satanists right now, and I'm looking at my recording here, and the file size just crossed over into 66,600 and something. Isn't that something? Just when you're talking Satanists and all this, 666 popped up in there. Just a coincidence.
Wow. But that's another thing is, you grow up normal, where you think Satanism is something that exists in Hollywood, or you have a bunch of lost teenagers exploring stuff when they're but you realize how it does factor into these things and into the into human trafficking, into elite pedophilia, because elite pedophilia, again, it's not just a question of sort of deviant elites satisfying their twisted desires. It factors greatly into how the intelligence agencies control the political process, because through human trafficking, they're able to compromise public officials. And once officials are compromised, they can be utilized.
Didn't you say something, one of your podcasts, you touched on that, where someone's home was found to be rigged with all kinds of recording devices?
That's pretty standard. There's a couple of cases. One was the case of Craig Spence. He was a GOP lobbyist back in the 80s. And he ran a mansion in D.C. that was wired for audiovisual. And he was having parties and then supplying underage girls and boys to various, public officials, elected officials, government officials, and that connects directly to the Franklin case, because basically it was Lawrence King, who was head of the Franklin Savings and Loan, which was also probably used as a conduit for drug money, for the CIA drug running in Iran-Contra. and all of see all this stuff kind of
I was thinking about that few minutes ago when you were connecting dots there, how again that's like that octopus and multiple tentacles. You can use this and it feeds into this, and then that benefits this area, and if you got problems this area can cover. It's like good, they got all the bases covered and they each support each other in some way or another.
But which is why whenever one tries to investigate this thing, they can't do it. They can't afford it because it unravels everything. Mm-hmm. It's all connected. Basically what happened was out in the Franken scandal was Boys Town, this Catholic charity, was being utilized as sort of a stable, or at least a hunting ground for young. By then it was both boys and girls, but they were getting young boys and girls to service the elite sexually. And they were flown around the country, and various witnesses testified to the other thing, four or five dozen, and the stories all kind of were consistent. But then, inevitably, they all recanted, except for a couple people. One was Alicia Owens, I think, who was sentenced to 25 years in prison for perjury, for not recanting. Another was Paul Bonacci, who was apparently was a victim, was involved in procuring too. Once he was victimized and traumatized, he became a procurer as well. And I think he said that he was involved in the case of Johnny Gosch, the paper boy from Idaho who was kidnapped. And he says Michael Kino was involved in that operation.
Johnny Gosch, is that the one? This sounds a bit familiar, where one of the speakers of the house, someone connected to the president, the mother found out that her son who had been taken ended up being, had changed his name, and that was someone who was working in the White House?
No, that was a rumor. I don't know how that panned out. There was a reporter who was also a male prostitute at a website. Mm-hmm. And his name fails me now. If he said his name, I'd remember it. But he was getting into the White House, logging in but not logging out.
Okay.
And this goes back to the Washington Times story back in June of 1989, when there's a call boy ring being run through the White House, and that factors into the Franken scandal. It was investigated. It was investigated by the Nebraska State Legislature, and that's John DeCamp, who spearheaded that investigation, and he worked with, he had worked with William Colby in Vietnam in Operation Phoenix. Which I don't know what to make of that connection. Some people suspect that John DeCamp was you get these accusations, and when you're investigating these things, that some people are
disinfo or
you don't know where to go with that. I don't know John DeCamp, so I can't speak to that. He could be an honest, he could be an honest person. I don't know, but he wrote a book. I read his book about it. His book seemed pretty hard hitting, so I don't know what exactly. We never know what angle could be covering up. You don't know. It's a limited hangar. You don't know. But he did work with Bill Colby, the former CIA director, who also was head of the Phoenix operation in Vietnam when he was there before he came back to head the Central Intelligence Agency. Incidentally, he came home in the 70s. That's when the serial killer phenomenon picked up. So, of course, he went missing, and then apparently went for a midnight canoe ride, and was found dead floating his canoe.
Wow.
Or floating in a river. But he was known for talking too much. But before his untimely demise, he had told John DeCamp about the investigation was that you can investigate this only so far. There are things and powers that exist that you can never challenge and you can't do anything about. And that's just the way it is. And that was the Franklin scandal, and basically it was a child sex ring that was used to satisfy the desires of various public officials, very high ranking, and also very important business people in Omaha. Now, what name conjures up there? Omaha, big business.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say, but anyway, that was Craig Spence's operation. And there's a recent book called DC Madam that has been written about a guy who ran. He ran he was a funeral director. And what happened was various officials were using their government credit cards to pay for his, he was a funeral director, but he really was running a call boy operation. Not a call boy. He only dealt with adults. That's how he got into trouble. He wasn't involved in pedophilia.
So male escort.
Yeah, male escort service. That's, yeah. Mm. And I forget his name, but he wrote it with the other guy who wrote about Franklin Scan. What's his name?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, darn it. Oh, well. I have my notes with me.
People can Google it. Yeah, Franklin cover up.
It's the Franklin cover up or the Frank? I think it's the Franklin cover up he wrote.
Right, because the book, there was a book and a documentary that was done by, was it the PBS or something, or
it was done by British Outfit, and it was scheduled to air in the United States.
And
it
got yanked at the last minute.
It got yanked at the last minute. Not only get yanked last minute is the TV Guide magazine. Some versions had it listed.
Right,
and it was wiped off the charts. That's yep. That's how much juice these people have.
Yep. But it can be found now, maybe. I don't know. But I know I have
on
it
YouTube.
Downloaded. Yeah, YouTube had it and some other like torrent sites and whatnot. So yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Fox is downloaded. I have it on a hard drive. But yeah, basically he was running a male escort service out of his funeral home, I guess. He was a funeral, but not a funeral director. What do you call that? A mortician?
Mortician?
Yeah, mortician services. Well, what happened was some investigative GSA just doing his job notices that his government credit cards are being used for all these mortician services. So he calls up this guy, what's going on here? The guy just, I don't want to talk about it. But it traces back to Donald Gregg, who was the chief of staff, former CIA agent and chief of staff, national security advisor, for then President George H.W. Bush.
Hmm.
Who later became the ambassador to South Korea, I believe.
Wow.
And Donald Gray, the guy who wrote DC Madden, claims that people like Bill Casey were the former CIA director, used his services, things like that in the 80s. So,
and it's not only in politics, because then we get to religion, they had, I recently saw this film that it's kind of quietly came and went, called Spotlight, and that's the one with Michael Keaton and Mark Ruffalo, and it's regarding, I think it's the Boston Globe.
Hey, I'm back. Sorry, my internet went down.
Oh, okay, it was on your end.
Yeah, it looks like it. Now it's back.
Okay. Yeah, I noticed I started talking about religion and the pedophilia, then boop, it dropped. I was like, wait, what happened here? But anyway, what I was gonna bring up was the current film in theaters that's quietly in and about to come out of theaters called Spotlight, and that touches on, I think it was a newspaper, either the Boston Globe or some newspaper out of Philadelphia or something, that they were touching on, a report of one incident of pedophilia, and they started digging in, and it turned out to be about 14 that came up in their investigation, and they dug deeper, and it went like over 100, and it was like, what the hell? So so that's pretty interesting how it's not only in the politics, but we've seen how a lot powerful institutions such as church and stuff like that this is also occurring there, and they show their power where they actually have money allotted aside to pay off these people that come with these claims. And they just move the priests around, and nobody's the wiser. But that's come out into the open recently. But even now, it's not as much of a hoopla. It's like, yeah, we know that's going on, but
that's what Bernard Law did in Boston, with the just shuffling him around and keeping quiet. But the funny thing is how the media will cover the Catholic Church scandal, but it won't cover Hollywood or or the police. So why is that? There's some sort of, but again, it is. It's much more organized than people care to believe. And the biggest handicap in really looking into these things is the aversion people have to it, because it's so disorienting. It unravels so much. Because you do get into human trafficking, drugs, and it involves these household names in politics, the Bushes and the Clintons and Denny Hastert.
Heck, if we get into entertainment, people, books like, I don't know if it was Kathy O'Brien's or the other one, Thanks for the Memories. Bryce Taylor that she Bryce talks Taylor, about, yeah. Even Bob Hope was her handler or stuff like that. It's like, wait a minute, what the hell's going on here? You know.
Well, that's another thing is I don't know. Again, standing aside or standing back, I don't know what to make of those accusations, but I can't disregard them.
Exactly. Yeah.
The thing is, because here's the problem. Most people think Bob Hope, he's Mr. He's a nice guy. You don't know Bob Hope.
Right.
Well, he's a presenter. You know what a presenter is? He's a showman.
Right.
So, and there are people that claimed that they saw Bob Hope with her at various functions. The independent third party, I think, what's his name? The guy who wrote the Manchurian Candidate.
Well, I'm not familiar with his name, but
Not the search for Manchurian, the other one. I forget his name. But he did see her being escorted around by Bob Hope. Okay. Kathy O'Brien's stories about President Ford and these things. You don't know what to make of that. I've heard reports that Cary Grant was a pedophile. In fact, I heard there's some people say that he was there the night of the Manson killings with a boy in the garden and ran away.
Wow.
Now, if you tell people this, because their image of Cary Grant is the Cary Grant that saw in the movies. This is the importance of cinema, right?
So look at Burt Lancaster, right? That was a big time actor and all this stuff, and then towards the end comes out with these things with AIDS, and now that leads toward maybe homosexuality. It's like, wait, what's going on here? People's perceptions or pictures are shattered all over the place, and
they don't want their illusions, they want their paradigm shattered, their illusions shattered. And so if you suggest that Bob Hope might be involved in this, but again, if you look at the intersection between entertainment and espionage and intelligence and drugs and Hollywood and the criminal underworld, it's all intertwined if you actually bother to read about it. The mob and Hollywood and intelligence are all they're all tied in together. The Central Intelligence Agencies the CIA was very interested in hiring magicians. Who's that guy? It was John Mulholland or something, the magician that they hired. And because it's all involved in illusion and trickery.
Sleight of hand and all
sleight
that.
Sleight of hand, yeah. And so it turns out that this came out when first I heard about it was Dave McGowan's Laura Kanin series, was that the magician in the 20s. What was his name?
Well, I don't know. I want to say Houdini or something.
Yeah, Houdini. Harry Houdini was an intelligence agent.
Wow, yeah.
And working for Scotland Yard, and that explains his meteoric rise, by the way. And that's another thing we have to get into is why do certain stars, because they serve certain powers, they do certain things, and they're promoted, whereas others aren't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, again, to suggest that what might be going on here is that the world, and if you are a celebrity, you would be a very useful intelligence asset, because you can travel around without any suspicion, get into places, see things, and do things that ordinary people couldn't.
Ties to what was that game show and that guy? They made a movie. George Clooney did a movie about that Dangerous Mind or something like that.
Oh, the guy who did the
Gong Show or something.
Gong Show, Chuck Berry, Barris. I'm sorry, Chuck Barris, and he claimed he was an assassin. And part of his cover was to chaperone the couples that in the dating game or something. And his job was to. Now, at the time I saw them, I thought it was just okay. This Chuck Barris was kind of a fruitcake. He's kind of different and weird. Mm-hmm. But then again, right? I mean. I didn't know what I know now, and so I'm thinking, well, that's not an implausible story.
Yeah,
it's and that's how it works, and that's why you get in some of these things, the controversy regarding 9/11, or when you get in the media fakery or what occurred that day, and I'm kind of an agnostic on it. All I know is I only experienced those events on the television.
Mm-hmm.
That's television. That was intermediary. So you experience those events, like the vast majority of people experience those events watching it on a two-dimensional screen. So to me, I can't discount the possibility that some of those images were manipulated.
All right.
And we could, again, if you get in this intelligence, sleight of hand, trickery, creating false reality, special effects,
Yep. Well, that's one thing I brought up before on another podcast. I think it was with Crystal also about degrees. There's different degrees of false flags. People think false flag, oh, you mean nobody died? Oh, you mean there weren't any planes? It's like, no, there are different degrees of a false flag. Like, you can have one like a Sandy Hook where probably no one died. They never presented bodies and they destroyed the school and destroyed all the evidence. And, you know, you get all this weird performances by that autopsy doctor or whatever, you know, just laughing there, and oh, my photographers are very, very good and all this stuff. And I was like, wait a minute, something's off here. So that's one aspect. Oh, and then you get the Super Bowl that same year that they have students from that community singing
unidentified.
Right. And a whole bunch of them are like, wait a minute, this looks like a 4, 5, or 6-year-old version of so-and-so that died there. What's going on here? But so that's one form. And then you have another form where people do die, you know, like Columbine shooting or this recent one in San Bernardino. But the false flag comes in where the people doing the killing aren't the ones that actually did it. You're being told it's someone else. That's a false flag. Yeah. So it there's different degrees to it, you know?
Yeah. But with a lot of these events, you have these people who just aren't acting normally. Mm-hmm. You know, Robbie Parker or something coming out and
smiles and laughing, giggles. Yeah. And then all of a sudden hyperventilating.
Yeah.
And
of course you have this character, or you have the supposed victim, this kid Posner, who showed up in Pakistan.
Yeah.
You know, so they have like a file of photos that they push, and you know, I think, is this like incompetence, or are they just doing this to screw with everyone's brains? You know, let's see what the reaction is to this thing. Let's see what we can pull off and make it so obvious and see what the reaction is. You know.
Probably, yeah.
You know. Yeah. Again, it's psychological warfare. So you can test
to see how dumbed down the population is. Like, wow, yeah, we actually did this. We used the same picture in two different places, and only like 3-5% picked up on it. Wow, we're doing a good job. Or then, by that same token, look, we're creating insanity on some people here. Some people are going like, I can't believe it. This, what the hell is going on? Like, good. Now we create another category of people we could control.
Yeah, and if you've let's get back to Michael Aquino. He co-wrote a document on psychological warfare, which targets the American people. Mm-hmm. Now, Pentagon denies that, but obviously the target of any psyop is always the domestic population. That's how you keep them controlled. Right. That's how you manipulate them. That's why there's propaganda, right? So it's always the target population, it's always the domestic population first, because that's the most important population that the government is concerned with. But here you have a Satanist writing psyward manuals for the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. And the Pentagon, you know, they have a whole entire, you know, sections with billions of dollars devoted to doing these things, studying. That's what these fusion centers are all about. That's what social media is largely about. You know, it's about creating, getting up the, you know, storing the data. It's all digital now, ones and zeros, and they can create various scenarios to various algorithmic formulas, and they can predict people's behavior just by amassing all the data on their behavior.
I know. I wasn't aware of this until a few years ago. I was gonna. The last year, I went to the Free Your Mind conference in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and a few months before that, I was online looking for my hotel reservations, airfare, and all that stuff. Fine. Now, after that, I go to another website, or I go to Facebook or whatever, and what do you know? The little ads along the side have similarities to the hotels and airfares that I was just looking at on other sites. I'm like, hey, wait a minute, what the heck's this? So there's that, everything's connected. It's like, oh, this is Ivan's Facebook, and we see that by his search engines he was looking for this, so we can limit everything else and just, you know, just show him what he's been looking for. He doesn't need to look at anything else, you know, and we can show his direction.
That's what Jay Dyer makes the point. He says that the don't worry about the NSA. NSA is Sprint. It's AT&T. It's Google. It's Facebook.
Verizon was the big one. Yeah.
Verizon, yeah. And so they're just getting all that data on you, and they're selling it. using it, whether it's intelligence agencies, whether it's corporate America trying to market things to you. It's all about controlling your habits and thoughts. It goes back to Edward Bernays. Mm-hmm. And so since it's all digital, this information is out there. It can be stored and analyzed. And that's why they built that huge data center out in Utah to store all that information. And it's going to be sold off, used all types, whether it's organized crime or government. But then again, I repeat myself. But
I know. Echo.
What? People don't realize, if you look at was it Progressive Auto Insurance has, it will monitor your driving. And if you drive well, you'll get a cut rate. See how James Perloff says, every snap trap has cheese, right? Mm-hmm. To draw in its victim. And that's what we have here. Everything, it's done in a convenience,
Well, that's how other people would see that. It was like, isn't that cool? Now I just go to Facebook and based on my other searches, they're going to pop up a deal that I didn't even know was happening. That's so cool. See, it was like, wait a minute.
It can sound benign, but information is power. Mm-hmm. Okay. We hear that. It's a trope. Okay. If that's true, then whoever has that information has the power.
Yep.
And you can home security systems, virtual security, where they'll monitor your home. Well, then someone's monitoring your home. A human being is doing that. The best security home is a good lock and a gun in the house.
That's it.
Not having some electronic security that can monitor you. And that's what's happening. TV sets. I mean, it's now known that these, like Toshiba and these TV sets, they monitor you. They literally record you.
The smart TVs, smart how? In what area? How are they smart?
And I heard somewhere that the first Apple computer sold for $666. Is that true?
The first what?
First Apple computer sold for $666.
Oh, wow. Those numbers. I don't know. Wow.
Not only that, this is the Apple. The bite out of the Apple. What's that?
Uh-huh. Exactly. Yeah.
But they say it was really a pomegranate. But anyway, but the whole point is, the information, people don't realize that they're being constantly surveilled for a reason.
Yep.
And social media, when people, you go on Facebook, you talk about what you had for dinner, or you're not home, we're going on vacation, all this is being stored. This conversation right now, I mean, I just don't care. I get you to. Now, part of that is the chilling effect. I think they want to let it get out there so people will edit their Google searches and what they talk about.
Right. Like you and I right now, we can just have a wonderful conversation on how wonderful our government is and life is great. And, thanks for the taxes being withheld and that paid for that wonderful road. And, all these wonderful things. We can be, the docile public just conformity,
So, one thing is, this is, a good example is that people, it's psychological. It used to be that you'd go to work without a phone and you make this long drive without a phone. Now people are if they leave their house without their cell phone, they panic and they have to circle back and get the phone because they can't imagine driving without a phone. Yeah. It started, I remember years ago, a few years ago, when my nephews and nieces were approaching tween years. And their parents were discussing getting them cell phones. And it was all, it's just good because if something happens, they can call us. It just makes us feel better, blah, 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 blah. Okay. Then within a few years, these kids, these teenage boys, or 13, 14-year-old boys and girls have smartphones with full internet access to everything.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you what a 14-year-old boy is going to do with full internet access. Mm.
Yep.
Yeah, and everywhere they go, and not only they're carrying this thing on their body, which probably causes cancer, especially when you attach it directly to your body all the time, but now they need constant internet connectivity everywhere they go. So that's how it goes, and it becomes the new norm. No more privacy, and with no privacy, they lack discretion. They no longer have any sense of real dignity or privacy anymore. What they talk about, what they post about other people. Someone throws up and their friends will film it and put it on Facebook without telling them about it and think it's funny.
Right.
And so lack of empathy, It's all part of the social programming that's occurring.
So sad. Oh, my goodness. Wow. Well, Tim, that would, putting aside that little drop in connection, I think we've done about an hour and a half or so. So,
okay.
This has been pretty fascinating here, conversation, picking your brain, I guess, letting you bring out a lot of stuff that I hope the listening audience will pick up on and go to your... You don't have a website, do you? It's more just on the Podomatic, right?
It's you can have a page. I have on YouTube.
Okay.
It's, I post them on YouTube. They're also Podomatic. Also, they're also carried on the UCOI network.
Okay. How do people access that? Is it a specific website? What do they type in?
Yeah, it's UCY TV.
Okay.
And they can go there. And my show, I think, airs every Saturday at 7 p.m., 7 to 8. And it's an hour, so often the shows that are posted there are after the fact, and I have to edit them to fit that hour time block. But they carry it, too. Okay. Whereas on Podomatic and also YouTube, I can go on for 3-4 hours if I want. So,
and you have,
yeah, I know.
And you have. Those are the good ones. Like I said, I'm at work at night with the headphones on, and I see on my phone, oh, there was a new episode, play, and there I am for 2 or 3 hours. Like, oh wow, fascinating, learning, taking more information in, and then sharing it with people. So yeah, keep up the great work there, Tim. So that's Our Interesting Times, and that's also available, I think, on iTunes. That's how I get it also.
Okay. So
yep, sometimes it pops up on iTunes as a podcast. So, all right. Well, Tim, thanks for joining me on Guy Next Door Speaks. And I don't know if anytime you feel like doing this again, if you have any ideas, you're like, you know what? I like to talk, bring something else out and put out there. Just we have our contact information. Just let me know and we can do this again.
Yeah, I'll send an email and invite myself.
Yes, invite yourself.
Well, listen, have a happy new year and Merry Christmas then.
Yep, same to you.
Thanks.
All right, Tim. Thanks for being on here. And that concludes episode number 13 of Guy Next Door Speaks. I'm Ivan from Phoenix. And as always, depending what time of day you're listening to this show, good morning, good afternoon, or good night. Be well.